cover. I just want to get this going. Sunday morning. Good morning. I'm John, compulsive eater. I have some Ask It Basket questions here, which is cool. I don't know if we still have any paper for the Ask It Basket, but maybe we can send it around some more, especially because they didn't think to do it last night, and then maybe there was some stuff that came up last night that somebody has some questions on. But we will get that going around again. And I guess I'll start by doing some of that and read some of the stuff. I'll leave this pad here in case anybody shows up looking for it.
Okay.
And, we'll do some Ask It Basket. I'll do some stuff here. We'll probably take a short break in the middle of this session so that people can stretch their legs. Maybe you'll have time to do some sharing. If not, probably the whole rest of the closing session, except for a little bit. We'll leave it for open sharing. So, okay, this one was answered. Some of the things that I didn't answer yesterday were ones I knew were going to come up last night. Let me just talk about some of these. People talk about accepting my fat self, quote unquote, and fat is beautiful, and this can be a trap. Isn't it a contradiction somehow? Well, you know, fat is just, in my opinion, it is the byproduct of compulsive overeating for me, and that if I, you know, one of the greatest lines I heard somebody say once is they said, "You take care of the fork, let God take care of the scale." You know, I just love that because it's like it's about that. But yeah, I hear some of that, and I think sometimes it's, you know, I can always say for me when I hear the phrase "fat and happy," I want to go really happy, really. Maybe I know for my background, I would have a hard time with that. And I can also tell you that, you know, I don't know if I've mentioned it here, but that Roseanne used to say, "I didn't start this to be a fat and happy club." It's about recovery from the disease. And I think if you recover from the disease, you will get to a healthy body weight. Now, again, you know, that healthy body weight phrase, it's got a huge amount of leeway in it, you know. I was up about 30 pounds a couple of years ago when I started doing that exercise because it was one of those things where my metabolism was going down and I wasn't changing my food. Well, guess what happens? This is not rocket science. It's calories in and calories out. And but I was still healthy because I could go out and run 3 miles, you know. So even 30 pounds up from here, which if you looked at the government chart, I would not have been considered. I mean, even now, I had a doctor tell me a long time ago that anybody who's been significantly overweight, and, you know, 100 pounds overweight like I was, is never going to hit those government charts. They're just never going to be able to do it. And I was way past that, but I could run. So I was technically at a healthy body weight, you know. I should have been keeping a better eye on it and doing some stuff, but I didn't. But, you know, but I think for a lot of people, sometimes it's your disease. I mean, your disease could go, "Don't worry, just be where you are." Again, if my disease can convince me I don't have a problem, I don't have to work on it, you know. So I fear losing weight. What advice do you have? Well, I think we went over a lot of that last night. These may have been pre-last night, that it is tough. It is tough to deal with because of all of the actual other things. And back when I was enumerating all those things of why I think compulsive eating is harder than a lot of other diseases, I mentioned, you know, it's one of the few diseases that if you do well, sometimes it comes with an extra set of problems, you know. You don't hear somebody in Gamblers Anonymous say, "Wow, I quit gambling, and boy, all the problems now that I'm having as a result of not gambling, it doesn't exist," right? You know, and it's where it gets a little hard, and it's just a matter of there's a lot of hands to reach out to here, a lot of hands who have gone through this before you and can guide you on how to deal with it and help you lose the fear to be where I believe my higher power wants me. My only belief is that, you know, when I was a kid, anybody who's ever called names as a kid, one of the names you got called was elephant, right? Elephant's the perfect weight for an elephant, right? You look at the way an elephant's designed and everything, God wants that animal to be right where it is, and I believe my higher power wants me to be where a normal human being is. And it's, I don't know, just for me, that's what I think it's all about, trying to be where we were with that. Where in the big book is the story about Fred? I think it's more about alcoholism. There's the three stories, and they're actually very close together. I know because we just got done reading it in The Vision for You. So I think it's in the... let's see, hang on. I'm pretty sure it's in the... it's in More About Alcoholism. I don't remember exactly what page. But the three stories... there. Okay, so the whiskey and the milk story is on page 36, and the Jaywalker story, I believe, is a page or two later. And oh, and then page 39 is Fred and the strange mental blank spot. What does it mean that I can be too smart for the program? Whoa, you asked the right person here. I was a know-it-all. I thought I knew better than everybody, and I wasn't teachable, you know. Like I said, there's way too many people too smart that don't make it, you know. Like I said, Murray, absolute genius. You know, I have pretty high IQ. He made me feel like Rain Man, you know. And he's dead. He's dead. The smartest guy in the graveyard, you know. And for me, I believe the thing is that makes this work is quit arguing, you know, quit trying to over-intellectualize it. And for me, that key phrase that came to me early on in my other program is take direction. Quit asking why about it. Just do it. You've had your life to try it your way. It didn't work. Maybe you need some help with that. And again, a lot of this has to do with that insanity of the second disease. And I have a disease, a state of mind that prevents normal perception. So I have the greatest decision-making abilities in the world. If I'm working on bad data, I'm no help, you know, to myself. So, would you repeat what you said regarding the checklist of emotional maturity? I don't have it right with me, but it was essentially a mature person has to accept reasonable delays, you know, to lose impatience over reasonable delays for the convenience of others, meaning I can't always have it my way. I live in a society, you know, I can't expect to hit every green light or sometimes to do things for so other people have it easy. And again, I think if we all worked with the idea, help the other guy, it would turn out, you know, the best for everybody. Can you talk about cross-addiction? Yes, I'm going to talk about that a little later. What was the nugget of wisdom the dude who, H-P-O-T-A, H-P-O-T-A, what is H-P-O-T-A? What am I missing here? Anybody know? Our power. I'm not sure. We're hanging on your every word. Had problems. Other. All right. Maybe if somebody comes up in the break who wrote that and explained it, I'll be more than happy to answer. How do I let go of the diet mentality, like thinking about calories, yearning to weigh daily, and romancing foods that are my red light foods? Well, yeah, that's part of the overall thing of recovery. Ah, here we go.
Two more.
Okay. Thank you, Marge. I mean, well, first of all, talking about calories, I mean, I got to tell you, at my age, I have to keep an eye on that. That's just data, you know? As long as it doesn't run my life, I think a lot of us are absolute experts in nutrition, you know? How many calories does it take to lose a pound? 3,500, right? Everybody knows that. They can tell you the calorie counts on 90% of the things. But what it really comes down to a certain extent is I remember at one point looking at, there's charts out there that will tell you if you're a certain age and you're a certain height, this is about how many calories you get to eat a day. Now, it doesn't mean I'm nutty about it, but I have to – and I tend to work more off of weighing once a week. And, you know, we were talking at the break about compulsive eaters versus compulsive overeaters, and I actually really like the phrase compulsive eaters better. First of all, I think it's way more inclusive. And also, who hasn't even if you got, I don't know how many years of absence, who hasn't overeaten at a meal? It's just going to happen. It's human nature. It's not like we're really trying to, let me see how much I can stuff down. But, you know, you're having a meal, especially a restaurant. I used to say, no restaurant in America ever went broke by giving people too much food, right? Okay. You know, and I have to be real careful about going out to restaurants because they're, for me, it's almost like license to overeat. Well, I'm only going to, you know, eat what they bring out. And then they bring out this plate like yay big. And it's like, well, there you go. I guess that's what I'm supposed to eat. No, it isn't. That's twice as much as I normally eat at home. And I have to, if I'm working a program of honesty, I got to say, wow, that's too much. And the funny thing is now we've started, my wife and I will get into this other thing now of going to a restaurant, getting a couple appetizers and splitting an entree because it's just too much for either of us. We're both getting to that age where the old metabolism has just slowed down. I used to be able to scarf down a huge steak and not, you know, be able to deal with it, but not anymore. So calories, I think, is just a legitimate piece of data if you can handle it, you know, and same thing with weighing. Again, I mentioned yesterday, I believe in weighing abstinence, because otherwise, if you guys see, there was a commercial a while back, I forget what it was, but it was a guy in a gym, and he gets on the scale, he checks himself, and then he goes, like, runs around three times and gets back on the scale, and it's like, yeah, I can identify with that one. But that I believe it is just, it is a way for me to ground out with reality and know that, you know, whether I'm doing well or whether I'm not. And, but to make it obsessive about, you know, when I really is trying to, you know, start to you know, get back on to exercising a couple of years ago. I knew I wasn't, especially at my age. Trust me, you know, when I used to try and lose weight, the curve would be like, you know, really steep. I could lose weight really quick. You get to a certain age, you start working out more, your body's like, yeah, I'll get there when I want to, you know. And then the other thing to realize is about scales and stuff is that sometimes it's not about fat. You know, weight is not always about fat. When I started exercising for a while, I gained weight. And the reason I gained weight, I was getting more muscles in my quads, and muscle weighs more than fat, and it was going to happen. But I also had enough time and program to know that. And I also knew after many years of weight loss that weight loss is not in any way linear at all. It isn't a curve. It tends to be, in my case, I can't speak for everybody's, it tended to be a stair step kind of thing. Because I would start to lose weight, my body would start to adjust. Oh my God, he's starving or something, and my metabolism would change, and then it would drop some more. But it's, again, it's not about the number on the scale as much as it is about, you know, my food. You know, like I said, you know, take care of the fork, and the scale will take care of itself. And romancing foods, that's just one of those things. My disease, the more I can think of those things as my disease whispering in my ear, you know, oh, you poor thing, you don't get to eat such and such. You know, how many things are on the market now that I look at and go, wow, I bet that's good, and it's been out since I passed, you know, eating things, you know, dark Reese's, you know, or drinks. You know, I never had a Long Island iced tea. They came in long after I got sober. But it's always going to be that way. There's always going to be something out there. There's always going to be a Walmart full of every kind of thing you can do. And it comes down to, are you willing to pay the price, you know? And the thing is, my disease will whisper, you know, you can have one of those. You know, if I could have one of those, I wouldn't be standing in this room right now. I don't know about you guys, but that's what my disease wants to say. This time it'll be different. This time I can have one, and while I'm eating that one, I'll try and jaywalk the trolley car, you know, because it's the same thing, right? Okay, let's see. Sometimes I resist what's good for me. How does resistance work? What strengthens it or weakens it? Ah, wow. And, you know, that's, again, trying to get where I stop and the disease starts, because that's really my disease. Anybody who's sitting here today wants to get better, or you wouldn't be here, unless maybe you just really like this neck of the woods and want to go out walking. But then what the heck are you sitting here for, right? But, you know, I think a lot of that's my disease. And again, some of it may be either resistance because I want to get back into food. Some of it's resistance from fear of, oh my God, what's going to happen if I do that? And some of it's, I mean, I've got that oppositional defiant nature and that slightly, obstinate character of, you can't tell me I can do. And around, nobody can tell you, you know. You can stay in this program until you're 110 and be 400 pounds till you're 110. Nobody's going to drive you out. But isn't the whole idea here to try and do the things that is suggested, especially if it's something different? Because, again, my own best behavior, my absolute greatest, you know, IQ of whatever the heck it is what got me in that door the first day, and miserable and defeated. If I can't generate this out of my own head, I've got to take some outside input and be willing to try. I used to say I was open-minded. And you know what that was for me? I'm open-minded, and I'll try what you tell me if I agree with it. You know, that's not open-minded. Open-minded is saying, well, I think that's, like I was saying with my sponsor, that's the stupidest damn thing I ever heard, but I'll try it anyway. Why not? You know, and to try and get the open mind. And that's where the resistance sometimes butts up against it, because I want to not do it that way. I will, if that's a personal note. What does my daily program look like? You know, this is the greatest thing of recovery. It just dawned on me. Every retreat I do, one of the first questions is, what do you eat? We haven't had any of those, so thank you for realizing that's not part of it. But I will talk about my well, I'm going to talk about some of it in a minute. Yeah, I am actually going to talk about some of my non-food program, but I'll also just tell you, I tend to eat three meals a day. And a deferred snack at night, which to me is, it's a deferred dessert, you know? And I like to have it at night because that's always one of my problems. And I used to fight trying to do not eating. And I said, well, wait a minute, maybe I can do this if I do it in a very controlled setting. So I tend to have a banana. A banana does it for me, you know? And then I also, like everybody else, I think, has red light foods, yellow light foods, green light foods, and, you know, in terms of true red light foods, not ones I'm still screwing with, but real yellow light foods, we were talking at breakfast. I said, there's foods I can eat, but I can't keep in the house. I can't keep them in the house because every time I walk by the cupboard or the refrigerator, it's going, John, I'm in here. And, you know, I cannot eat them like a gentleman. And, you know, that's, you know, they talks about in the book about not being able to drink or, you know, or eat like a gentleman, like a lady, you know. And I have to be willing to look at that and accept it. And I think in a lot of ways, the more work you do on your program and the more honest you get with yourself, you turn around one day and go, oh, I've got to give that up. Because some of these things that I fought with for years, I'd be like, oh, I can have this. I can have this little thing and I'll take it and I won't have it again for a month. You know, and then the next time it'll be 3 weeks. And the next time it'll be 2 weeks. The next time it'll be 1 week. And then, you know, and the ability to finally realize. It's like the half measures avail us nothing illusion. I always say there's an illusion to half measures avail us nothing, in that half measures sometimes can seem like they give you half results. And they will, until it all falls apart. And then you're down there and you turn around and go, wow, they were right. Half measures availed me nothing. It may have seemed like half at the time, but then it all fell apart. And so, for me, I have to be so willing, you know, if I really want this to work, I have to be willing to go to any lengths, which means sometimes being willing to give up foods that I really, really, really like, but I can't eat them like a gentleman, you know. Okay. Can you give specific sponsees of what you say or ask your sponsees who are still struggling? How do you help them figure out what the problem is and how to address it? Well, I believe in program, I tend to do it differently. I talk about how to address it, and then we'll figure it out, you know. Because the 90% of the things, like I was saying yesterday, were I ate because of this, I ate because of that, I ate because of that. No, you know, you ate because you're a compulsive eater. Which segues me into one of my favorite little writings from the fourth edition when it came out. And anybody who's interested, it's on page 450/451. Okay? Not 449. I got a little resentment against AA that when they went from the third edition to the fourth edition, the 449 went to 417. I'm like, what? You guys are so smart. You couldn't figure out how to keep that one on page 449? Right. Right. But anyway, 450. I want to read this to you. I think it's such an important thing. Then I realized I had to separate my sobriety from everything else that was going on in my life. No matter what happened or didn't happen, I couldn't drink. In fact, none of those things I was going through had anything to do with my sobriety. The tides of life flow endlessly, for better or worse, both good and bad, and I cannot allow my sobriety to become dependent upon these ups and downs of living. Sobriety must have a life of its own. And I think that's so important. And what that gets down to is the wonderful two-word phrase, excuse my French, shit happens. And it's going to happen for the rest of my life. And if I say, well, that's why I ate, well, then man, maybe it's something really hard, you know, it's something really hard to go through, something that a lot of people go, yeah, I could see wanting to take comfort, you know. Hey, look at 9/11. Right after 9/11, the average weight in New York went up something like 30 or 40 pounds because that was what human beings were doing. They were comforting, you know. But we can't do that because 95% of those people in New York at some point, maybe in January, said, wow, I'm overweight. I got to cut out this eating, and could do it. You know, God bless them. I really wish I could do that. But the idea that if something really legitimately bad happens and you eat over it, then the next time, that's a pressure valve. And then the next time, the spring on that pressure valve is going to get just a little weaker. And then the next thing that happens may be really big, but a little less and a little less. And like I said, eventually I'll be breaking my abstinence because I broke my shoelace, you know. So I will talk to them about that. In terms of what kinds of examples I say to sponsees, I have a sponsee from London who's really had some problems and holding together. And I remember saying to him, you've got to make, forget everything. If he was sitting in here hearing this weekend, I'd tell him, forget everything you heard, everything you heard. There's a lot of great stuff that you will get to once you've got the food under control. Right now, getting the food under your control should be your full-time job. It, you know, take all that obsessive compulsive energy and put it into keeping the food down, three meals a day and nothing in between, because that's the most important thing. Without all that, I can be, again, like I said, I can have wonderful words of, I mean, my insanity, when I was going through that relapse, I remember one time coming into that, one of my meetings and saying, yeah, I ate last night. And I said, but you know, in the big book it says, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, I'm quoting the big book as to why I binged? You know, if you don't see the insanity of the second step in action there. But that's the thing. I needed to make putting down the food and keeping down the food the most important thing. Over in my other program, you hear the phrase more. Two phrases you hear way more in AA than you hear in OA. First of all, easy does it. You know, I look at my other program and I see all kinds of personality types over there, you know. All kinds that get bit by the alcohol thing because it is such an addictive substance. But I come here and I see all my people. I see my personality type with lots of people. And I just think, you know, the line I always say, I can complicate a two-step process, you know, and the thing I need to do is lose all of that extraneous stuff. And I think some of that's my disease, wanting to whisper, oh, but what about when the big book, it says this, keep the food down, keep the food down. And like I said, my disease, its main job when I was going through my relapse was to get me to somehow kick the can down the road on doing what I believe is the way to recovery, which is to get the substance down. And last one of these before we go on. Can you repeat where you can find the maturity checklist? Somebody mentioned it yesterday. Yeah, I had thought, because it had been so many years since I had actually a physical copy of it, I thought it was its own thing in Al-Anon, but I understand it's in another pamphlet. There was a person who was talking about that to me here, but it's in an Al-Anon pamphlet. I don't remember what the name of it is, but it was a thing called the checklist of our emotional maturity. I can tell you, if the internet is as good as I think it is, if you type in Google a checklist of our emotional maturity, it'll probably come up. And it's got a lot of other ones that really are germane to my personality type, but that was the one that really jumped out at me. So, so I don't know. Do we want to keep the she put the Escape basket back. I don't know if we want to try keeping it going around, and I'll check at the end and see if there's anything else that's going on. Everybody may be done with that. Also, yeah. I also noted, you know, we always Sundays is always, you know, there's a lot more spots in the line, you know. But that's the good people, or not the good people, but the you know, serious people. And we few, we happy few, we band of brothers and sisters, from Henry V. So let me talk then about, I had gotten up to step seven, you know. I humbly ask that I be relieved of the shortcomings. Again, I believe, I believe in the idea of a higher power relieving me of them, which, you know, When I first came in, I would read humbly and humility, and at first I thought of like humiliation and things like that, or being humbled. And then I went on and started thinking, oh, that means I got to walk around like Gandhi, you know, and be humble and, you know, I don't know, wear sandals and whatever. And what I got from an old sponsor is he said, humility is just an objective view of yourself and your place in the world, you know. And the more I'm around, somebody mentioned being in the, I had always heard that, a good hunting dog is in the middle of the pack. And and it means that I'm not at the top of the heap and I'm not at the bottom of the heap. You know, I'm just another bozo on the bus, you know. I love, say that somebody talked about that once and said, I'm the piece of garbage the world revolves around, you know. Only they didn't say garbage, but we'll let that go. But the whole idea here with humility and saying I'm just another bozo on the bus, it keeps me teachable, you know. You know, again, when I was new, I was so arrogant, and I'd hear about people doing things, and that would never happen to me. And now I know, no, there, that could happen to me. There, but for the grace of God, and that I need to be careful of that, you know. The other thing about thinking of myself as such a piece of garbage is it's really grandiosity, isn't it? It's grandiosity in reverse. If I'm going to be I don't think of myself well, I'm not going to say I'm a little less than everybody. I'm going to be the worst piece of garbage in the world, and that's really more grandiosity in a way. I somehow feeling I wasn't enough, it soothed my fragile ego sometimes. The trouble with grandiosity is it also tends to intensify fear. My problems are the worst, you know. You know that great line about from the promises, fear of financial insecurity. You know, I would take things and I would catastrophize. Like, you know, there's a thing called catastrophization. You don't just take something and make it a little; you make it the worst. You know, I work for myself for a living, and one of the things for people who work for a living is it isn't a steady thing. You'll have more work than you can handle one day, and then you won't have any work. And part of my little child of alcoholics catastrophization brain goes, that's it. You're going to be living under a bridge in a box. You know, you're going to be selling oranges at the end of the off ramp, you know, and it'll still pop in my head. And, you know, luckily my recovery said, all right, calm down here, you know. You know, quit the histrionic Sarah Bernhardt. It's not going to be like that. The worst that'll happen is I have to run a balance on my credit card. Oh, my God. You know, thank God we live in a time where we do have bridges when we go through things. And I can go, this is just a cash flow problem. I got to remember that. For, you know, and maybe not for everybody, but just giving you an example of that. You know, and again, I think of, you know, it's a lack of humility and also a lack of faith, you know, in belief in all of those times when my higher power gave me those bridges when I thought I was going to, you know, have something happen and realize it's, you know, if that happened before, it's probably going to happen again, you know. And the other thing about, you know, losing these character defects is it's a lifelong task, you know. There's no way it's ever going to happen, you know, perfectly, you know. I can make the first steps toward trying to work on my shortcomings. There used to be a lady down in our neck of the woods who moved up somewhere up here, and she used to say she had written down her top 10 character defects and laminated the card and kept it in her pocket and would at least once a day pull that thing out and just look at it to remind herself of those things and helped her get through the day a little better, you know. But, you know, I don't know how it is for you, but with me, it's the thing it talks about in the AA 12 and 12, where it says about this step. This does not mean we expect all of our character defects to be lifted out of us as the drive to drink was. A few of them may be, but with most of us, we have to be content with patient improvement. And that, to me, if I'm on the path and I'm really trying to do it, it's going to get better, but it's not going to be, it's not going to be a linear thing. It'll be two steps forward, one step back, because I'm a human being and I want to be a better person and I'm really trying, but on any given day, I may revert to type. You know, I remember when I first came in, some person might say, an alcoholic under enough pressure reverts to type, you know, and what that meant, you know, for me is not necessarily turning the food, but, you know, if I know I'm going to go into a situation that's going to be, you know, fraught with some possible things, I can sort of steel myself like a family thing. Oh, I got to go see family, the people who push my buttons. You know, what's that great line? Your family knows how to push your buttons because they installed them, you know. And it's true, you know. And I think it's more, you know, about trying to improve the ratio of good to bad, you know. I tried to play golf because my father played golf, and I you know, and it drove me crazy because I learned to play tennis and I got really good at tennis, and it was a reasonably linear curve. But with golf, you can go out and hit a 300-yard drive down the middle of the fairway and then walk up and go boom and hit it and have it go 3 feet. And there's nothing more frustrating than going, but I just hit a 300-yard drive. So, and with golf, it's getting better and having that good to bad ratio. And that's what I think it is with our character defects. You know, I think it's unlikely all of my character defects will be removed, you know. You know, we joke sometimes, like over in Vision for You, they're big on saying, I'm a recovered compulsive eater versus recovering. And I understand that comes from the foreword of the first edition. We are 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So when it comes to my, and doesn't mean you can't become unrecovered. Don't get that wrong. It doesn't mean, you know, you can become unrecovered, but you are recovered. And I am recovered in the physical stuff. Am I recovered spiritually and mentally? Wish, I really do, you know. I'm going to be recovered spiritually and mentally about 20 minutes after they put me in the ground, I think, you know. But you know what it is that helped me is going through the steps over and over, you know. You know, there's a theory. My friend Sheila says it's the New York group versus the such and such group. Some people say, oh, you only go through the steps once and then you stay in 10, 11, and 12. But for me, I found going through the steps over and over was important, mainly because it involved for me peeling the onion. You know, the more time I got in recovery, I mean, I don't like constantly one after the other, but I would go back and do the steps over and over because. Like I said, you peel the onion, and all of a sudden, stuff you didn't even think of you'll be reminded of, or stuff you didn't even think was a problem, all of a sudden you realize, no, you know what, that's not honest, or something like that. So I really believe in continuing to do it. I always say the really frustrating thing, though, is the more I peel the onion, I swear to God, they're making more onion on me as I go along, you know? I'm going, where the hell's the bottom of this goddamn thing? You know, but part of it is being able to realize something's a defect, and I know when I did my first fourth step, there was probably a lot of things there that I didn't even realize, because it took me years to, and listening to other people and hearing about other people's defects and stuff, I began to realize, oh, wow, I do that too, you know. In the eighth step, made a list of, you know, all people we had harmed. I believe this step is the number one place you need sponsor input, you know, because when I was working on my eighth step, I would write down the ant I stepped on in the first grade, but I'd want to use the wonderful except when to do so would injure them or others excuse to not, you know, make an amends from something else. And that's where I needed a sponsor to go down that list and go, no, no, you don't need that. Put that one, you know. Because remember, it's not about people you feel bad about. It's people you have harmed and need to make amends to, you know. It's not going to do any good to go up and go, you know, I always thought you were an asshole. You know, if I never did anything to hurt them, that's I got to hold that down myself because it accomplishes nothing, you know. And I remember when I worked on my first one, I bring in my sponsor, and he's like, how long is this thing? Chill out, you know. And that's the thing. It's not meant to alleviate my guilt, you know. It's meant to be in a list of amends we make, you know. And again, that except when to do so loophole. I remember saying to a sponsor once, and this is one of the things, when you make amends to other people, they're not necessarily innocents, you know. They may be people who did just as much harm or maybe even more harm to you, you know. And I remember saying to a sponsor once about this one thing where I, you know, did something to a guy, well, you know, I really was right in this and I'm afraid if I make amends to him, he's going to think I'm saying he was right and he wasn't right. And my sponsor just looked and said, John, we're doing your amends. He let him worry about his amends, you know? The other place there's a bit of controversy is do you put yourself on that list, you know? And AA purists will say, no, nothing in there about that. I happen to think, and when I thought about it for a long time, this is one of those places I changed my thinking on it because I tended to, you know, buy the AA party line totally. And the longer I was around, I said, you know, most compulsive eaters, the number one victim was themselves. Yeah, it doesn't mean our lousy behavior didn't make us hurt other people, but You know, they didn't gain 100 pounds. You know, they didn't walk around living this diminished life. I did. And I don't think it is a bad thing to do. I'm not saying you do much about it, but just to realize, hey, I was a victim here too, you know. Ninth step, you know, make direct amends to such people we had harmed. To me, this is the hardest step in a lot of ways. This is where, you know, a lot of the other steps are lip service in a way. But this is where you got to suck it up and go talk to somebody who harmed you. And again, like I said, that you harmed, that sometimes also harmed you, and be willing to go up and just clean your side of the street, you know. You know, now we have to take action, as it says, and because that's what into action, the chapter in the big book. You know, and so sponsor said it didn't say into thinking. You know, my sponsor was always trying to get me to quit over intellectualizing everything. And one of the first examples I saw of why this is a good thing. Again, a lot of these things that seem hard are also selfish in a way, because when I'm done, again, one of those other things of I got to go through it and look backwards to see how it is good. Because, you know, it was really hard to make some of these amends, you know. But I remember one of the first times I got sober about the same time as this guy Stan, and he was a house painter. You know, we were all going to meetings in this AA clubhouse. And Stan talked about how he said, you know, I really felt bad at the end of my drinking. I worked for a contractor. He was my best buddy. And he and I were like, you know, close and everything. And I got pissed off at him, and I just up and quit and really left him in a lurch. He almost lost his business as a result of what I did. I got to make amends to him. And he would talk about this more than once at a meeting. You know, so finally one day he comes in and he's like whistling and all happy. I go, oh, you look good. What's going on? He's like, oh, I finally made that amends to my friend, the boss. I said, wow, you're really happy about this. I guess it went well. And he said, no, as a matter of fact, you tell me to go to hell, and he hung up the phone on me. And I said, well, why are you so happy? And he says, because it's his problem now, you know. And it really was. It wasn't like he went there just to make amends, because that's what the program told me. He genuinely felt bad about this. He genuinely did what he could to clean his side of the street. And it wasn't received, but he did his part, you know, and that's all he could do, you know. You know, and then it talks, you know, again, because some of these were, we were wronged, you know, I have to remember about my amends, and I learned to take my amends and break them up into three parts, you know, which is amends I'm ready to make, amends I'm not ready to make yet, and the no way in hell amends. But write them down, get them ready, and what you'll find is as you start to do the I'm ready to do amends, and you get the better feeling back, and you get a lot of positive feedback. You may get an occasional go to hell, but people like to be magnanimous. People like to accept amends. You know, that's the way it works best. And so as I was doing, you do those, then all of a sudden some of those not yets will move over. They'll move over onto the I'm ready. And maybe some of the no way in hells will move over to the not yet column. And slowly as you do this, and you get that you get to see how it makes you feel and makes you realize you're cleaning up your side of the street. Eventually some of those no way in hell ones will get to the point of you being ready to do them, you know. One of my favorite stories about making amends was this lady named Maxine from our neck of the woods. And some people may know Maxine. Maxine is still around in program, and she's been in program since 1961. She came in a year after OA started. She was the first treasurer of OA. She ran the San Fernando Valley office for many years. And Maxine would tell this story about how, in addition to being a compulsive eater, she became a shoplifter. And that was part of her thing. And when she got better, she knew she had to go make amends to some of these, you know, stores. And I remember she said it was the May Company down in downtown Wilshire and Fairfax in downtown. She lived in the valley. And she had to suck it up and go over and talk to them. And Maxine left a note for her husband, who was at work on the kitchen table, that said, if I am not here and you're reading this note, I'm in jail. Come get me, you know. talk about willing to go to any lengths. And, you know, she got to the makeup machine. She says she walks in and tells them, and they bring out a manager, and he's like, he has no idea what the heck to do about this. He says, well, you know, we've gotten these kind of things before. They're usually a letter and a check in it, or, you know, in some way, but we've never had anybody actually show up. We don't know what the heck to do. And I don't know what the actual outcome was with that. I don't remember, but, you know, sometimes it'll be writing a check to a charity. It'll be doing something, because sometimes you can't do a direct amends on things that involve, you know, tangible things like money. The other thing about this is it requires the fortitude of being willing to go in and say something and then sit back and accept whatever those results are going to be. And they may be no way in hell. They may be, oh, you know, you forgot all these other things you did, and have somebody just angrily rattle off more things. And again, if you're not ready to accept that, maybe back off. Or if you're not ready to accept the possibility that could happen in any of your amends, stop. You know, I've always heard, if you're having trouble doing a step, maybe you need to back up and you didn't do the step before it right, you know, or well. And and again, I got to believe with the progression of these steps, I start to get the faith. Even if I don't have a faith in a higher power, I get faith in that process. I've seen up until now all these things that I had to look backwards to see why they worked, and the trust, the chances are, if it was that case for steps, you know, 1, 2, 3 through 8, that it's going to be true for 9. And to be ready and say, I got to clean up my side of the street. I think it's so important, you know. And sometimes, again, how do you make amends to dead people? You know, you can't really. I know a lot of people go to the graveside and read their amends out loud. And, you know, who knows? Who knows? That might be heard. You know, I don't know for sure. Nobody does, but try your best to do that kind of thing. Or, you know, if it was something, let's say something financial, and you know that person, you know, had a charity they liked or something like that, write a check. But, you know, again, also maybe try and express how you felt about the whole thing. You know, yeah, because and it's important. It was something I was going to say about amends. Anyway, it'll probably come to me, or it won't, because I'm getting older. The other thing I always say to sponsees, remember, the word they use is amends, not apologies. You know, because amend means to change, you know. And, you know, what good is it to go out and make amends for one behavior and then to just keep doing it on and on, you know, in your life, meaning you're racking up other amends you're going to have to make later. You know, I really believe it's about changing that in some way. See, what was I saying about that? And so, you know, that is to me, that's what makes the 9th step, you know, tough. Let's see, what it began at 10 o'clock. We go to what, 11? Right? Yeah, 11. Okay, I'm pretty sure. In the 10th step, okay, continue to take personal inventory. I always said this is the one I really grabbed on to quickest and did the best early on. I just wish I didn't have to do it so much, right? You know, the good news is the longer you're in program, the quicker that gap gets from the time you do it and realize it to when you actually try and do your best to reverse it, you know. But the reason that I came to do this best, I turned on a dime of my lifetime behavior. Again, in my house, if you admitted you were wrong, you were a target. So I had to work really hard. I mentioned it yesterday about making these intellectual justifications and rationalizations of why I did this stupid thing where I acted like a jerk, but it was actually your fault or somebody else's fault. And now the wonderful relief of being able to go, you know what? I screwed up. I'm sorry. I mean it. I'm sorry. I lost my temper. I did something like that. Because I was saying before, when I go into a situation, like I said, a family thing, that I know is going to be tough, I can sort of get myself prepared program-wise, or sometimes bookend with a sponsor or somebody saying, I got to go see that family that drives me crazy. I'm going to call you later and tell you everything went okay, hopefully. But it's the things where I use the analogy, if I walk around the corner and it slaps me in the face, that's where I tend to sometimes revert to type, and then I have to make an amends. But the wonderful thing of just being able to say, I screwed up. You know, I screwed up. I will try not to do that again. And it makes it better. The other thing is the AA 12 and 12 about that hits me more than anything else about the 10th step, restraint of pen and tongue. That is the tough one for me. And I have rewritten that to the modern terms, which is restraint of pen and tongue and send button. Because I find, you know, this is one of the things now of you know, getting some email in or text in that I will tend to, I could possibly misread and then, you know, want to flame back at it. I had an old therapist. The therapist before the one I see now, who was also a techie, which really helped me. We sort of bonded because he could talk to me in the language. I always said there's a difference between the science of therapy and the art of therapy, and that is the science of therapy you learn in school, but the art is what comes later, and in the idea in particular of how to communicate certain things to knowing the patient. And knowing what you can do and how you can say. I remember one time I said something about, about this and this. And he just looked and go, yeah, you wish, you know. And I laughed. I go, do you talk that way to other patients? And he says, no, just to you, because I know you can take it. But he told me, because he was a techie. In fact, he ran the doctorate program at this Riocon College down in L.A. And he ran his entire doctorate program and classes on this huge computer with this huge computer monitor and these things that look like, you know, everybody was on and he could see the students. It was like a big Hollywood Squares kind of thing. But he said he had analyzed this whole thing and that there's such a difference between the normal kind of communication we do and what we do online. So because normal communication, like right now you're listening to me and as I'm talking, you're hearing the words, but you're also hearing my vocal inflection. You're seeing my body language and my facial expression. Well, even when you go to losing the face-to-face thing, you have the telephone, right? And in the telephone, you can at least hear vocal inflection. But when you get to something like online, either an email or a text or a posting on a board, you don't have that. And he said he believed that these other forms of communication other than internet, because of that nonverbal stuff, the emotion of the speaker is imparted. The trouble is that when you don't have that stuff, the emotion of the reader is imparted in the sentence. Hence why I write some innocuous thing and get flamed back because that guy's having a bad day and reads it wrong. And you know what? I've done it too. You know, I've done it in the opposite way. And it helped me realize, you know, I got to change the way I do that. And, you know, one of my favorite thing I learned as I was reading a biography of Harry Truman. And Harry Truman had a real hot temper and he became president of the United States and it's really not a good thing. That's a bad combination, you know, especially now if you have a red button there. Yeah, I know, we know. Outside issue. But so what Truman learned to do was when something really bothered him, he had some senator who was doing something, or a newspaper man in particular. It was this one story about his newspaper man who had criticized his daughter, who was trying to be a singer and wasn't evidently very good. He would sit down and write these excoriating letters. You dirty so-and-so and so-and-so. And he'd really write this nasty thing. And then he'd take the letter and he'd put it in the drawer of his desk. And it was the fact of getting it out that dissipated 90% of his feelings, you know. The funny postscript to that story is when Truman got out of office, he set up the Truman Library in Independence, Missouri, which I've actually been to, and they shipped his desk out there. And they just taped up the drawers and sent it out. And when they opened it up, here's all these letters, you know. And in fact, there's a book, if anybody's interested, there's actually a book out that where they compiled those letters. And I'm sure they didn't put the really good ones in. But I got that it's, wow, it's sometimes it's about expressing it and getting it out. And so sometimes now I will, if I get something in where I realize I'm writing this sort of flame thing back, I'll say, you know what? If I'm right about this, I'll be right about it tomorrow morning. And I'll, instead of saying send, I'll say save. And look at it tomorrow morning. And 90% of the time when I do that, I either really tone it down or I delete it altogether. Because one of the problems with coming back with flames, even if you're right, is people's defenses go up. And I always say, if you come at somebody, even if you're right, like really hard, you can watch the words bounce off their head because they can't hear you anymore. And if I want to make a point about something, I have to find a way to, you know, impart it as an adult in a way that was good. Heard a great line a while back talking about amends and daily stuff. This woman said, "I don't worry as much about the food going into my mouth these days as I do about the words that are coming out." And I love that. I go, boy, ain't that the truth. And doing 10 steps during the day, you know, I'll have sponsees. You know, where was I? You know, all the things it says in the big book. And the funny thing is, in the big book self-check, there's like about three different versions of that. You know, page 69 says, where had we been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Page 67 says, where were we selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? That's the one I used to hear. And in 86, it says, where were we selfish, dishonest, or afraid? Well, 67 and 86 pretty close together. But take your pick, you know. And then about the big book, you know, they say, well, the big book gives you a lot of general things, doesn't have too many specific things. Well, you know, it does. It does on, I believe it's page 86, you know, where it says about the 10th step, when we retire at night, we constructively review our day. And it gives pretty much a list and to consider, you know. And it says, you know, constructively review our day toward what can we do better, not pull out the bullwhip and start thrashing yourself. And I know for me, I tend to try and do that at the end of the day. I don't sit and, for a while I was actually writing out things, but I'll be like, okay, what did I, you know, how'd things go today? Is there anybody I really didn't act appropriately with? You know, if I'm trying to live a 12-step life, you know, did I do that? You know, and try and see, make a mental note, you know, I got to make an amends to that person tomorrow. The other thing some people do, I actually got this from Michael B., the AEIOU inventories. You guys heard of the AEIOU inventory? Oh, there it is over there. You got a
paper over there.
Ah, yeah, there we go. Tell me if yours is the same as mine. A is abstinence. E is exercise. I, meaning me. You know, did I do A is was I abstinent? B, did I do some kind of exercise? I, me, did I do something good for myself? O is others, did I do something good for other people? And you uncover, is there something I realized about myself? And then some people put Y for yippee, something really good that happened in them that day. And, you know, write the next paragraph or so right after that very specific directions in the big book about retiring, you know, at night and reviewing our day. It goes and segues right into the 11th step of upon awakening, we consider the 24 hours ahead. And you know, that really goes into stuff and talking about prayer and meditation, you know. You know, I always heard prayer is talking to God and meditation is shutting up and listening, you know. And I really believe in that. The other thing I really believe in, and it's just, you know, my personal belief, is that the most important word in the 12 steps is the word only in the 11th step. Praying only for knowledge of His will and the power to carry that out. Again, because the higher power I had before was Santa Claus. You know, tell me, here's what I want, you know, instead of saying, you know what? You know, I got to accept what comes. And even if you don't have a specific, you know, idea of a higher power, it's more about, you know, going with life. I spent so much time battling things over which I had no control and just that, you know, churned up my guts and made me frustrated, instead of saying, you know what, maybe instead of being the salmon swimming upstream, I'll just turn around and go with the stream, and it's certainly a lot less exercise, you know. And again, yeah, Richard mentioned this yesterday. The great line from page 560 in Alcoholics Anonymous, we are taught to differentiate between our wants, which are never satisfied, and our needs, which are always provided for. And again, looking back in my life with the Bugs Bunny thing, a lot of my wants never happened, but man, you know, my needs have always been taken care of. And the more I got that, the better I felt. The other thing is I changed my wants a lot from coming in the program, you know. When I was newly sober, I got sober in this town called Norwalk, Connecticut, and one of the guys I got sober with was this guy named Dally. Dally was a piano player, but Dally grew up in Greenwich, the place I grew up in, except the difference between Dally's family and my family is Dally's family was loaded, okay? Loaded. It's a comic named Ron White who talks about his in-laws. Loaded. And he told the story about when he was a kid, 11 or 12 or something like that. They were sitting at the dinner table, and his mother was giving his father a really hard time because the neighbors next door had just gotten a second Rolls Royce, and they only had one. And mom said to dad, "If only I had a second Rolls Royce, I'd be happy." And Dally told the story. He says, "You know, I was 11 years old, and I knew that anybody who needed a second Rolls Royce to be happy was never going to be happy. Because when she got the second one, there'd be something else." And the light bulb went off on me about that. You know, not about Rolls Royces, but that I keep putting conditions on my happiness. And once this happens, I'll be better. Or once that happens. And, you know, that thing from Just for Today, you know, that Abraham Lincoln said about a person is as happy as he sets his mind to be. And to realize, you know, there'll always be something. If I'm going to have conditions on my happiness, there's always going to be something else between me and that happiness, you know. And part of that is, you know, again, one of the things that's good about getting older, you know, I used to say, watch out for OA. When I came to OA, I didn't need glasses and I didn't have gray hair, you know, see what OA will do to you. But the reality is I became an old timer and, you know, like they say, how do you get to be an old timer? Don't drink, don't die, you know, or don't eat, don't die. Part of this prayer and meditation for me was about, for one thing, I'll just say, I know that people may have their religious beliefs, and I'm not talking down your religious beliefs. My brother certainly does. I'm not a fan of intercessory prayer, you know, praying for something, either for me or for other people, because I don't know what the hell's good for me. I certainly don't know what the hell's good for you, you know? I mean, I remember somebody at a meeting once going, "Oh, I'm up for a job, pray that I get it." No, I'm not. Because what if you get that job and it's the worst job you've ever had in your life, and the best job you were ever going to get in your life came next week. But because you got the job today, you didn't get the best job of your life next week. And to realize, I just got to pray for the best for that person. Pray that their higher power gives them, you know, all the things that I would want for myself. And that's just an opinion of mine. You know, again, take what you want. The other thing, the other thing about being older is I can look backwards at my life and realize that some of the biggest disappointments I ever had, it's sort of like what I just said, the biggest disappointments I ever had led to some of the best things that ever happened to me, you know? And to realize that maybe, you know, my higher power has a different plan, and right now it feels bad or it feels uncomfortable, but it's going to lead to something even better. And realize I have such a small view of all of that, and that if there's a higher power, they're looking, him, her, it, is looking at a bigger picture. I heard somebody say once, "I was praying for a bicycle, and God gave me a Lexus." And I was like, get that Lexus out of the way. I'm looking for the bicycle I prayed for, you know, and not realizing certain things. And to keep your mind open about prayer and meditation, to think, wow, maybe this thing that just happened, there's a reason, and to think maybe I can utilize it, you know. And considering that, you know, over in improv, one of the things you learn in improv is never deny. So if somebody says something, you're supposed to go yes and all the time. And some of that, if you think about instead of saying, "Oh, that's a horrible thing," so, well, wait a minute, yes and, maybe there's a reason. What can I do? Can I work with this and have this be something good? Let me see what I have. And then the whole other idea, God's answer being yes, no, and wait. You know, sometimes I got to realize there may be a reason, I have to wait for it, you know. And the whole line about be careful what you pray for, you know, you might actually get it and then realize you shouldn't have been praying for it. The other thing you hear a lot, and I really think this is true sometimes, rejection is God's protection. You know, maybe the thing I'm praying for is the worst thing for me. I don't know it. Or maybe that guy I really would like to ask me on a date, you know, would turn out to be, you know, an abuser or something. And even though I was disappointed, maybe that was the best thing that could have happened to me. You know, I love Harlan's got a great line. He says, "Don't tell your God how big your problems are. Tell your problem how big your God is." I just always thought that was a great line. And this is one of those things where, you know, somebody was asking me earlier about what my daily program looked like. You know, for someone like me, the loudmouth I am, praying is easy because it's, you know, involves talking. The sitting quiet and shutting up is sometimes hard for me. I've also got an A-type personality, so I tried meditation a number of times, and I just couldn't make it work. It was either very hard or I would fall asleep, you know? So it was really hard to get in that mindset. But then, and I remember talking to my old AA sponsor one day. He says, you know, maybe you got to think of trying to find a form of meditation that'll work for you, you know? So he suggested this one thing. He said, get up in the morning, don't turn on the TV, don't turn on your computer. Make yourself a cup of coffee, you know, and now it's tea, and consider maybe just getting quiet for a while. Don't jam into the day and go crazy. Get into a program spirit. I'm also a big believer in getting a program book or two to read, because one of the things that happens is I'll read something that would never have popped into my mind, you know, without having read that, and it'll invariably be exactly the thing I needed to hear because of something that happened later in the day. You know, oh yeah, and you know, higher power, I don't know, but you know, it's just an interesting. And how long does it take? It doesn't take that long. My old sponsor Carl said he was taught by his sponsor to whatever reading he was going to do to read it twice, because you tend to be a little fast on the first time, and the second time through it sort of sinks in a little more. Just a thought. The other adjunct that helps me with meditation now is a dog. I have a dog named Lila that I have to walk every morning, and I try and go out and walk and take the time. I have a really nice neighborhood, and I can walk and sort of think about, okay, what's going on today? What am I going to have to do? What's coming up? Is there anything I've got to be on guard about? And it really helps me. It allows me to be the author of my day, as opposed to the events taking over, you know. And I always say invariably, once in a while, it doesn't happen that way. I got a client who calls up with a screaming emergency, and instead of being able to do that, oh, we should really take a break in a second. Instead of doing that, look at that. Ha ha, psych, I'm not going to do it. No, well, I'm getting right up to the end of 11, so we'll do that. When I don't do that and I have to hit the ground running, I always say my day invariably doesn't go as well. I always say I feel like that day I was thrown out of a car at 60 miles an hour and I'm just trying not to go face down into the gravel, you know? Whereas if I can start my day in a program way, again, like I said, I get to be the author of my day. I get to stand and start to walk instead of being thrown out of that car, you know? The other thing that came to me and helped me with that whole idea of, like, instead of, you know, beating myself up that I don't do as well meditation as other people is I was told meditation is focused thought, you know. Instead of making it into a huge thing, make it focused thought. Now, I can say I have talked to a lot of people who got into meditation, and they said that their key was incremental. See if I can get through 5 minutes, you know, get through 5 minutes, and maybe you do 5 minutes for, you know, a couple of months or maybe a year, and then maybe it goes up to 10, you know, a little more, and that it really helped them a lot in getting better. I know one guy said something about your higher power doesn't speak in a loud voice, so you got to get quiet to be able to hear it, you know. And it's just always a great thing to be able to calm that noise in my head, to get in touch with that and to live a little bit more of a program life. So I'll break here before we get into the 12th step and a couple other little edging things before we end. So let's take like a 10-minute break and we'll come back.